I was playing this little game, Jenga, with my son. He was very little at that time. And, you know, you take the pieces out, and that's exactly the analogy. This whole entire ecosystem is connected.
Mm.
It's like a huge Jenga. And as these species are going missing, the whole ecosystem is starting to get very wobbly. We don't know when that last one piece will come out, and then we all fall apart as an ecosystem. And there's no survival for human as a species standalone unless we keep it intact. That's kind of the biggest issue that disturbed me quite a bit. And then I talked to Ares, and we all started to come up what we can do. And we have DNA pieces that we can bring to that Jenga resolution, which could help many different things. So that's DNA Zoo.
Welcome to Season 3 of Herstory. This season delves into the stories of inductees to the Western Australian Women's Hall of Fame. I'm Beck Bowman, and I'll be with you each week as we get to know these remarkable women whose lives have had a profound impact on communities throughout this state they choose to call home. Together, we'll meet women who are cultural and environmental custodians, women in STEM and in business, women who care for the health and well-being of those around them. Women who are changing the world from right here in WA. Parvinder Kaur is a biotech pioneer with an entrepreneurial mindset. In addition to operating DNA Zoo, an open source global consortium which shares the DNA profiles of thousands of animals, Parvinder is the co-founder of Xplanta, where she and her team use synthetic biology to solve all kinds of world problems. Kaur is motivated by her Sikh faith, a faith instilled in her during her childhood in northern India. This is her story.
Kaya, namaste and sat sri akal. It's a pleasure to be here. This is Parvinder Kaur from University of Western Australia. I am an Associate Professor of Biotechnology and the Founder and Director of DNA Zoo Australia.
Your formative years were spent in India. Was the whole time spent in Punjabi, or did you move to different cities?
Fortunately, my dad was in Indian Army. So I was born in Gujarat, which is a region outside Punjab. So Punjab is up north. Mm-hmm. So I was born in Gujarat, and I was only 13 days old when we moved actually from Gujarat state to Maharashtra state. So I've had an opportunity to sort of go around and live around India.
Mm-hmm.
And I had the privilege to learn several languages, several different cultural backgrounds and things, because India is like a mini Europe.
Exactly. Like, people think that India is a monolith, like it's a very homogeneous culture, but it's not. Like, there's so many different languages and different cultures.
And food. Because
food.
You travel in India, like you go like 50 kilometers or something, the whole outlook of the people, how they dress differs, the spices differ, the language changes. So it's incredible. That's why it's called Incredible India.
Yeah. I mean, can we talk for a minute about Palak Paneer and Dal Makhani, which I think are both...
two of my favorite dishes.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Amazing.
I just cooked Dal Makhani last night, so yeah.
Yeah. Excellent. So we can have a recipe swap after this.
Absolutely. Happy to.
Did you always know that science was going to be in your future when you were growing up?
I would like to say yes, because I was very, very young. I come from a very religious family. Mom and dad both wake up at like 3 a.m. And even now they're retired, they still wake up at 3 a.m., which I do not understand.
Mm-hmm.
But they would do all their prayers and read that with us as we grow up. So I've seen the religious world very closely. And interestingly, I have been intrigued and fascinated. And that's exactly where my science bent started, because Indian Vedas, the old literature, has actually quite a lot of things that makes complete sense when you look at the NASA calculations of today's age. And those books or those scriptures are from thousands and thousands of years old. So that really fascinated me when Mom would tell me all those stories. And I would just say, I needed more evidence. you know. But when you tell someone from a religious perspective, it's like a storytelling, but it doesn't have a lot of evidence to that. So that's, I think that's exactly where my curiosity started. I wanted to find more logic, more reasons underneath. I never doubted that, but I was just curious to know more about those things.
Did you find that curiosity and then finding that evidence strengthened your faith?
100%. And it's day by day more I'm learning about life at the DNA, at the very, very basic base pair level. More I'm intrigued, and more of those things which I have actually grown up with, reading and exploring in the religious scriptures, they're all starting to make a lot more sense. I'm really fascinated that, are we reinventing the wheel? Are we going in circles? Because the languages disappear. We do not have the same level of intellect to translate those scriptures or literature anymore. So maybe the modern science is trying to do things again, which has already been, there's a whole world. And I think that that's really fascinating, that how different disciplines in the world converge, like from a religious point of view, from a cultural point of view, from history point of view, and from the modern science point of view.
And those are all disciplines that we hold to be very, very separate.
Yeah.
Whereas you're saying, no,
they all converge. We are all connected. So are the disciplines, and so is everything else in this universe.
It's really interesting to me that your dad was in the army, because the Sikh culture is a warrior culture.
There we go.
Your name actually means
Warrior Princess. Yes.
Which is amazing. I love it. How was that passed on to you, this knowledge, when you were growing up in your family?
So Sikh cultures, we have three key pillars to our faith. The first one is work hard. We call it Kirt Karo. And the second one is Vand Shako. So Kirt Karo means work hard, as hard you can work. And Vand Shako means share the fruit with everybody among the community. So that's kind of like the two key pillars I've grown up with. When you follow the path of truth or working hard, there will be a lot of times, it's not going to be easy. So having that Robin Hood personality, or kind of like having a warrior personality, is always coming in handy. And then when you want to share among all as well, it takes a big heart to do that, right? Because normally we say, oh, this is me, this is my hard work, or this is kind of like I earned it. But we never say that. It's just not in the practice in our community. It's always we. Mm. It's for us, you know, to share. And the biggest one is that I grew up, and all the Sikh prayer, like we do the prayers, it all ends with the last line is Sarbat Da Pala, which means prosperity for all. And that's exactly the basic ingredients, or the values, you can say, that I've implemented into all my research programs. And DNA Zoo is exactly like that. This was the very first program or an international consortium where we actually share data that we generate without any restrictions with everybody.
It's amazing. So DNA Zoo is a open source platform. Absolutely. Where you've mapped the DNA of a whole bunch of animals.
Yeah, so far we've done about 390 plus species across the globe. Many, many iconic species you can think of. In local black swans. And why are they so susceptible to the highly pathogenic influenza? That's another thing that we can probably talk a little bit more detail. Beloved quokkas, the koalas, you know, the Gilbert's potoroo. You know, the one of the most endangered or critically endangered species on the planet, less than 100. All these genomes and the data, open source, available for everybody and anybody to go. And if they can make anything, build on that to save the species. That's kind of the whole idea.
So if we just go back a bit, when you were in uni, what was your first degree in?
When I was growing up, you know, my dad was an army. So we will go for summer holidays back to his village. And we will stay with my uncles who were in farming. I was heartbroken as I was growing up and kind of like looking for what to do. I had a curiosity for science. I was really good in that as well, so blessed in that space. I saw my uncles work really, really hard, and they're feeding like the world, the farmers, the farming community, but they were very poor. And it was very hard for a farmer who's feeding the world to have 3 meals a day for his own family. And that really impacted me when I was, you know, teenage at that point of time. And that's when I decided that I wanted to learn what is the reason for that and can science help. And those were the days when BT cotton was just coming into play. And that was a game changer for the agriculture sector, because normally my uncles would do 11 sprays on cotton crop, and it's like putting a lot of poison into the soil. But at the end of the day, all of what they could have actually made a revenue out, they've actually spent in saving the crop from the insect. So that's exactly what my first degree was, agriculture honors. And I wanted to put all the bases behind it and understand and how to make it better in the future.
What's BT cotton?
So BT cotton is genetically engineered crop. So when the American bollworm attacks the plant, the plant only has a gene that can affect the acidity inside the American bollworm, and it kind of kills it. But it doesn't kill us or anybody else. It's kind of like that particular gene-specific editing that was done. It's a biotechnological revolution. Nowadays, we've got many, many such crops which are resistant to particular pests or diseases because the genetic engineering has made it possible.
Yeah. It's interesting that you talk about Indian farmers feeding the world and not being able to feed their families. Just to give people an idea of the seriousness of this issue, the suicide rate among farmers in India is
highest.
One of the highest.
Absolutely, yeah. Yes.
Over the last decade, that's really kind of come to light, especially over COVID as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a huge, huge, huge issue, and an issue that does not make sense. And it just does not add up. Mm. Like, how can someone who feed the world cannot feed their family? So there is that can be unpacked in many different perspectives. But, you know, the corporatization and the government policies and the way the whole setup is there, it's not to support the people who work at the ground level to actually, you know, put food on our plate and keep us going and alive.
So seeing that as a teenager was this really core memory, this belief that was inbuilt into you that this isn't fair.
No.
And I want to do something about it.
Yeah, and I wanted to do something about it, but my dad always told me that, you know, let your work do the talking. And that's exactly it. I will have lots and lots of questions. I will ask, like, and I will challenge. So I was like one of those teenagers, including my teachers, my professors and everybody. But then I will just go away. My strength was like my curiosity and my persistence to answer the questions, you know, and then I'll come up with my hypothesis. And it was like kind of like I did not know that, but that is exactly what a scientific training looks like.
Yeah, you're practicing. Farming.
Yes. It's been a lot of fun. And because I come from a nation where science is done at the cost of starvation. So everything I've done in my scientific career is like not for an H index as a scientist or not for like that kind of a kudos to publish in the best impact factor papers and things like that. It's always been driven by how can I change? How can I change for a better world?
So you did your honours in agricultural...
Agriculture, plant protection.
In this, like, pursuit of developing solutions for farmers on the ground level?
Yes, it was very ground level, but it was all in biotechnology space because I've always been fascinated about...
Yeah, like you weren't out there digging the fields. Like,
no, but yeah. I was digging in the DNA. I was still digging.
when did you decide that your next move would be to Australia?
You know, grown up in and raised in an army family, the last thing I would do is leave my country. Mm. And that was not a thought that ever came to my mind. Here I am. I am the topper in my university, in my batch, a gold medalist, got a scholarship to do my master's in entomology, which was looking at the insects more at a more higher resolution, and got a job straight away. I mean, I finished on the 26th of May and 27th, I joined in the university because I was very, very fortunate to be in that space. And the first couple of months in my job, we would go to villages and we'll run plant clinics to help the farmers and things like that. And that is exactly what I studied for and my entire life. You know, the farmers, I'm a woman. Mm. Mm-hmm. And we were only two girls in the entire batch of that agriculture degree between 2000 and 2006. Those were my 6 years in the agricultural university.
And batch is usually...
I think our batch was 101.
And it's like your year. So your year group is mm-hmm. your batch, yeah? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so yeah, my year group. So two girls, anyways.
2%.
2%, yep. Got to the job. It's firsthand dealing with the farming community. Going to the field, I know exactly what the problem is and I have a solution for the farmer, but I was invisible. They will just straight walk past me and go to my colleagues, whether they have a solution. And they'll come and ask me, Parvinda, what do you think? You must know this and all that sort of stuff, because it's identifying the symptoms and trying to provide a solution. I really tried to engage with the farmers and the field trips and stuff. And then that was really frustrating me because I wanted to help and people didn't want to engage with me. After a couple of months, the head of the department said, maybe Parvinda, you want to do a desk job, that might be a lot better for you. And I'm like, no, I want to go out there because I want to understand the problems more and so that I can have more solutions. So that invisibility and being a woman didn't go in my favor in the agriculture space. So that's when I started looking. I thought maybe it's just my country, you know, this is how it is in India. And maybe I should go outside and I will have a better application for the skills I've built. And that was the time that I cleared GRE, TOEFL, all those exams, and then applying for scholarships in America, as well as somebody said, would you like to come to Australia? Because I was presenting and one of the professors from UW was there. And I applied and I got the scholarship.
What was your studies at UWA?
So UWA, I came here on an international postgraduate research scholarship, and I want to give a big shout out to the Australian government for having such scholarships that provides opportunities to many people like me and transform our lives. I came to do a PhD in plant pathology. So from insects to pathogens. And that is another thing. In my country's education system, we're not allowed to change disciplines like that, which the Australian or the Western systems are allowing. So that I think that's an incredible thing, because that opens up your horizons and that lets you parachute out of the narrow discipline space, and you can connect the dots better.
It also allows for that cross-pollination of disciplines.
Absolutely.
That we were talking about before. If you only ever study one thing, you might get very, very good at that one thing. But if you're able to bring in knowledge from other areas,
you can go down a rabbit hole very easily. It's not a criticism, but it's exactly what happens in our scientific disciplines, that we go deeper and deeper and deeper, which is amazing because we bring that resolution to the world. But at the same time, we also disconnect from the real world problems while we are trying to achieve that. Somewhere we have to find a balance, and connecting the discipline and having the capacity to work across disciplines helps with that.
And you've definitely kept your feet firmly on the ground and firmly understanding or attempting to understand what problems people are facing and what problems our wildlife is facing. Tell me about the origins of DNA Zoo.
It's a very interesting story, and it was a Friday afternoon thing that turned into this big consortium, which is international and across, 12 plus countries now. When I finished my PhD here in Australia, I was employed as a postdoctoral fellow to find a connection between the sheep burping and the methane hole in the environment, right? And there is a huge connection because 40% of these emissions are coming from our livestock. One sheep, 20 to 30 liters a day of methane goes into the environment, and one cow, 200 to 300 liters. This is a very complex problem, from sheep genetics to the environment. My first move was can I just kind of put the very basic of the feed? Because I did a lot of literature search, I found that it was the feed that was the most influential factor, that what sheep would eat is actually, if they can't digest it, it will burp it out and it goes to the environment. And so I wanted to go to the basics of what's in the feed that is making it so. Can we change that? And then that's how we can solve probably a complex problem. In terms of the base pairs, if I can just do a comparison. So humans have got about 3.2 billion bases in their DNA. It's 3.2 billion letters written in each cell of our DNA. We have about 37 trillion cells in our body. So do the maths, 37 trillion times 3.2 billion. So it's a massive scale of data.
I'm not going to actually do the maths there.
No, don't do the maths. But it's just a ballpark. The feed source that was the Australian key pasture species, or we call them clovers, the lucky clovers. Like, you know, we find the four-leaf clover or the five-leaf clover. Mm-hmm. So that is our key Australian pasture, which their livestock uses. So I wanted to put that genome together. Never been done in the world. And I went on a journey. It took me 7 years. Went around, you know, $500,000 and went around the world trying to put the bases together. And then in San Diego, I was attending this conference, and this guy from the medicine comes in and he talks about his invention and a new technology that he can read the things in three dimension in the DNA space. And I just stand up there and I did a standing ovation. I was like, this is what I need. And he's like, what do you need it for? And I was like, to put the genome together of an Australian key pasture species because I want to solve the methane problem. He looked at me because he was a medicine person. Mm. And he's like, sorry, we don't do weeds. And I'm like, no, it's not a weed. Anyways, kept on emailing him for 6 months. He didn't respond. And one day I was attending another conference in US, and late in the night, I didn't give up on him. I stalked him on social media, on Twitter, everywhere he was, like, and followed his research thoroughly. He's one of my dearest friends and in town today because they're visiting us. And he is also the founder of DNA Zoo from Baylor College of Medicine. Professor Ares Aidan Lieberman. He is the inventor of the HiC. It's a technology to read DNA in three dimensions. He just replied to one of my texts. He's like, okay, come to our lab and see if you can work a blood protocol into a plant protocol. And I'm like, yeah, sure.
He gave in.
That was the beginning. The grad students in his lab who only worked with humans and diseases and cancers and blood, they got so excited. There's someone who's doing something else. It was very refreshing for them in the lab. When it worked, they got all even more excited. Houston Zoo was across the road. We started testing and trialing different species across the tree of life. And that's DNA Zoo informally started. After 5 years, we kept in touch. We became really good friends, you know, and did a lot of brainstorming that what is the biggest challenge in the world right now. And that's when I came across a news article through UN that there's about 1 million species at the door of extinction. We lose one species every second right now. Like, as we are talking, we will probably end up losing like 60 to 100 species in this time frame. They're never coming back. I was playing this little game, Jenga, with my son. He was very little at that time. And, you know, you take the pieces out, and that's exactly the analogy. This whole entire ecosystem is connected. Mm. It's like a huge Jenga. And as these species are going missing, the whole ecosystem is starting to get very wobbly. We don't know when that last one piece will come out, and then we all fall apart as an ecosystem. And there's no survival for human as a species standalone unless we keep it intact. So that's kind of the biggest issue that disturbed me quite a bit. And then I talked to Ares, and we all started to come up what we can do. And we have DNA pieces that we can bring to that Jenga resolution, which could help many different things. So that's DNA Zoo.
You've made it open source so that people can use the information in their own projects. Mm-hmm. What are some of the projects that this information has been used for?
So as we speak about open source, so when we started DNA Zoo 5 years back, normally what scientific community or scientists do, we work for KPIs. You know, we have to publish in the best possible journal for that. We keep it a secret until we're actually ready to give out everything. That's a process which takes a long time, you know, 5 to 6 years. So just imagine that the Gilbert spotter, which is less than 100 right now, they really immediately need help and they need this resource. But I am a scientist who is not ready with my full paper yet. So I'm going to take another 2 years by the time they're gone, you know. So that was the whole idea and the value system that we put together, that if we're going to do this, this is how we're going to do. Universities were not in favor of that, but we went ahead and did it.
And that system of keeping that information secret until published is at odds with the SEEK value system.
Exactly.
Of what's mine is yours. Or
work hard, share among all, prosperity for all. Three pillars of SEEK. I mean, thanks for connecting. But that's exactly how I'm wired to think because of my community value system. Mm-hmm. You know, that was easy for me to say, I put my hand on it and this is how we're going to do it. Whether it's going to fit in my KPI system, okay, fine, I'll find another job or another way to do it. But this is what I learned all this science and did all this education.
build and this is how I can share it with the community.
Yeah, it was a game changer. Now, in terms of usage, for example, I give you the black swan story. Growing up in India, I thought white swan is the normal and black is very unusual, right? And we all think that. I published a paper this year. We put the black swan genome together in 2018. That was the world's first. We released on the WI Day. And then our collaborators from Queensland and UK, they did the mute swan. And the reason to do that was in 2017, there was a paper published where they tested the highly pathogenic influenza virus on the black swans. There was five swans and they were all dead in no time. Mm. So that was very concerning. I was curious that, is that real? And how can we test it out? And why is that reason? So when we did the black swan and the mute swan, we lined them up to see what are the differences and stuff. The most interesting thing we found is actually black is the normal and white is a mutation. So what happened during the evolution, there was black swan originally on this planet. And then the one letter, a mutation happened, and one letter goes missing in the black swan genome. And the rest had started backfilling that letter. And that caused a frame shift mutation in a gene that is responsible for plumage color. How cool is that?
That's amazing.
That was the reason for the color. But then the most important thing that we set out to find out was we found that the mute swans has a system that they were able to recognize the virus very quickly. And they were able to, activate their immune system to deal with it. That's why they were not dead. But the black swan, because they've been living in such a protected environment, they have never actually seen anything like that, like a highly pathogenic influenza. We don't have that yet in Australia. It didn't know how to do it. It didn't evolve like, the tail and the humans and all that sort of evolutionary studies. Some things that we don't use, we lose them in evolution's era. So that's exactly what happened with our black swan. So this kind of information is critical. Like COVID happened, we were able to come up with the vaccine so quickly because we could predict exactly what the mechanism is and how the vaccine need to be developed. This has prepared us. If something happens with our black swans and the highly pathogenic influenza comes, we know exactly what to do.
You've said that you don't feel that the Minister for Agriculture is doing enough to prepare for the eventuation of this highly pathogenic flu among the black swan population?
I think, look, government is really trying. I'm actually very pleased with this particular government, like how much they have invested into the science and technology, and they're really coming together with the scientific community and kind of holding these discussions, and we have access to them. So I'm really, really grateful to them. In terms of preparedness, I think, yes, we can definitely do better than this because Australia has a very, very wide coastline, and one bird with infection can arrive from any channel. And then what is our response plan? I mean, being a scientist or maybe being an OCD person, I like to have a more prepared response, and not like being proactive is better than being reactive in a situation like this, because the damage could be quite big.
I mean, their plan at the moment is to monitor very, very closely.
I don't agree with that. I think we've got enough monitoring and enough data on that space. I think rather than spending more money on monitoring, we should actually be ready, because we know what's happened around the world and it's not too far away for us to experience that.
And fortunately, I guess when and if this does happen, there will be the data available to be able to jump to some action very quickly.
Look, we've got the basis available.
Yeah.
We can tell exactly what needs to be done. But at the end of the day, things like this requires a huge government led initiatives and the kind of the resources required. Those resources required, being proactive is like a very tiny amount. But when you are actually in a reactive space, when it has happened, they multiply hundreds. And that's another reason that I think being proactive is better.
Pavinda, I am very interested in this idea of mapping genomic sequences in order to develop cures, develop treatments for issues that come up, like COVID, like the highly pathogenic flu virus in the black swans. You come from this heritage where, here's another word where I can't pronounce it, Ayurveda.
Ayurveda, yes, the bush medicine as yes. per Western Australian. Yes, yes, Ayurveda, absolutely, absolutely.
And you've spoken, like we spoke at the beginning about how you found that there were connections between religion and science. Have you also found that there are connections between these traditional healing modalities and the genetic research that you're doing now?
200%. And that is exactly the reason that that makes me even more intrigued because, you know, like we have lots of problems right now in the world. And I'm one of those people like, I don't know, I'm seeing solutions around me all the time. Like we're surrounded with solutions. Mother Nature has all of them. You know, we're just not looking at them probably. Take example of cancer. It's such a huge problem for humans, right? Whales don't get cancer. Horses don't get cancer. And in Ayurveda, my mom told me the other day, she's never been to high school, but she was telling me like, oh, you didn't know that? I was like, no, I didn't know that horses don't get cancer. She's like, oh yeah, in the past there was this guy in our village and then the Ayurveda, you know, the master, he gave him horse poo. And that changed his microbiome. Like, I mean, she said it in her language, but that's exactly scientifically it is. And we know that these days, microbiome transplants are literally happening to cure for a lot of diseases,
right? They're
doing
fecal transplants.
Yes, they're doing it,
it's
right?
It's amazing.
It's just we're going back in circles, right? So basically all the solutions are around us. If we're looking for anti-aging solution, you know, elephant sharks are the slowest aging animals on the planet. Going to space, you want to fuel that? Whale oil. I mean, I don't want to promote that, but that's actually, that's if we can synthetically produce and learn from the whales how they produce the whale oil, there's base. And that's exactly what my startup does, you know, like synthetically produce molecules that nature can't produce in big quantities so that you don't damage the nature, but you have a more cleaner, greener solution to such things.
This is your startup, Xplanter.
This is my startup, Xplanter. Absolutely.
So we're moving from DNA Zoo, still going, still open, still available for everyone to use, to Xplanter, which is more, I guess, entrepreneurial. There's more of a focus on how can we use this technology and use the knowledge that we have to develop solutions that will not harm the environment, mm-hmm. but use those existing animal and plant knowledges.
Absolutely. Yeah, animal, plant, microbes, everything that is alive on this planet, there's so much to be learned from them. So if I talk about Xplanter, we have to go back to that sheep and the clovers. So I worked on clovers for 10 years. I was the first one to put the whole DNA map together for the clovers. And I call them clever clovers because I learned in Japan that the Japanese were really investing into my project because they were really interested in deriving one of the biomolecules which clovers produced in the highest quantities, and it's called formononatin, to cure menopause in females. And there was a huge pharma application. There's about $300 million industry out there. And I was like, wow, that's interesting. And actually, to be able to produce that particular biomolecule, I had to bump up the function of a gene, which is really not good for the sheep themselves, but who are eating the clovers, because they get a disease from that, and their lambs, like, they go infertile. So there's like, look, this is a double-edged sword. You can use it in whichever way. You know, it's great for humans, but it's not great for our paddocks and our animals. You wouldn't want to put it in the paddock, right, in an Australian context. So that's what I put it in a yeast, which you can brew. You know, in your lab or in a brewery, like Little Creatures or somewhere, and you can produce this biomolecule as much as you like.
So you can have a beer that is
kombucha. I'm gonna make a kombucha.
You're gonna make a kombucha.
I'm gonna make it fun.
That is menopause stopping.
Yeah, it's one of the most proven active ingredient to help with hot flushes in females when they're going through menopause.
Have you made this kombucha?
No, we have the proof of concept.
Like, is it for sale?
Yes. No, it's not for sale yet. It's kind of proof of concept done. We've got a patent in, application in. We now need to take it to a scale that you can start to sell it, right? And WA has its own way of doing things. And we've got, like, we don't have that level of infrastructures that you could access in Boston, say.
Yeah.
You know? So this industry is going to come very, very strong. And this is the way for the future. You know, you don't need to kill the nature. You don't need to kill the whale. You can have both. Humans, you got brains. Let's use them. Let's find those solutions.
I mean, you are definitely using like all of your brain. Because what's interesting to me is that you are a scientist, you're a research scientist, you're like fully into these questions that you've developed since a teenager, working through hypotheses and training in the scientific model. And yet you are also a entrepreneur and a science communicator and a involved community member. Do you think that scientists need to, in 2023, be scientists and?
I think that this is a very deep perspective change and a narrative shift. So my son, he thinks scientists are mad because that's what they play in the school, you know, mad scientists. There's a huge perception. Being a woman scientist, that's another perception. You know, we've seen when you ask somebody to draw a scientist, there has been a whole movement, you know. It's very hard to imagine a woman, a dark-skinned woman coming from a country, a third world country like India, to be a scientist and be successful at the same time. And it's not just a perception in the common people. It's also a perception in the very best and the brightest academic learned community, that people think that if you're a good communicator, if you're out there talking, or if you're an entrepreneur or you're a business person, you cannot be a good scientist because science is not there to make money. But my question is that if science is not going to make money, then how is it going to sustain its operations or do the things that really, really matter for the community? Because, you know, yes, grant fundings are there, governments are there, but at the end of the day, how long the governments will fund such things, right? There's so much to be done. And scientists are the best and the brightest brains we've got. And if we can't sustain our fields, then, I mean, we have a problem there. You need to be out there talking to investors, and you need to break your science down. And we need to start this at the very basic level when the kids start getting introduction to science. It's like a holistic approach. Not just trying to make better scientists for the future, just do the better maths or better calculations.
Ayurvedic approach to science and to the development of solutions. So you mentioned your son, you have a vested interest in the next generation.
I do.
Like, I just have this delightful image of you 8 months pregnant, sitting there with a piece of paper, writing out the Punnett squares, like...
I was working until the last minute. I did drive to the hospital myself for my delivery.
Amazing.
And my supervisor was like, Pavinda, we really do not want to see you in the lab. And I'm like, just one more thing. I know I'm going to be gone for next like 6 months. I just need to get this experiment so that I have the data to analyze while I'm sitting at home.
He's like, no, sorry. We really don't want to see you give birth in the lab. Like, yes. Please just go.
Yes. Yes. That was serious. But, you know, that was good because time flies when you're working on your passion things, you know, passion projects.
What's it been like for you as a mother seeing your own genetic material replicated in your child?
That has been the nature's most wonderful, wonderful power I have seen. I think I changed that day quite a lot, how my brain functioned as a scientist, like when I had my child, my boy. It's just amazing. Like, I've got mole on this side of my face and he's got exactly the same location. And I'm still looking for explanation in a logical sense that how does that trait transfer from one to another? A lot of things, you know, I'm seeing. It's just incredible, incredible Mother Nature. I mean, as I was saying to you, I feel like some days that we're living in a very sophisticated, programmed environment in here. And there is something out there which is kind of like the Matrix movie, you know. It's kind of somewhere real in my mind. It's a really cool programming.
Pavinda, it's been so nice to speak to you. Thank you so much for making the time to come and do this interview for Her Story and share this story of yours that is so involved and has so many layers and is doing so much for the community, not just this little community in Perth, but the global community. I'm just astounded by meeting you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Beck. And thank you so much for running this Her Story. I think it's pretty powerful. Stories are very, very powerful. And I cannot say thank you enough for this platform for many like me to be able to share their stories.
Thanks to Pervinda Kaur and all the women at the WA Women's Hall of Fame. And thanks to the incredible women and femmes who make Her Story on RTRFM happen. Our executive producer is Danae Gibson. Rachel Ang and Madeline Mitchell are our assistant producers. Emily Jane Reid is our production assistant. Our theme music is an original composition from Annika Moses with artwork from Peter Roebuck. Her Story is an RTRFM podcast series about women in the Western Australian Women's Hall of Fame. This podcast was produced on Wadjuk Noongar Buja. RTRFM acknowledges and pays respect to the Aboriginal elders of the land, past and present. These lands were never ceded. This podcast was made possible with support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find out more at cbf.org.au. My name is Beck Bowman. Join us next week when we meet the founder of the Claremont Therapeutic Writing Centre, Melissa Henry.